Development as a global objective for improving human welfare is a relatively recent concept. It was first embodied in the United Nations Charter, which stated, and I quote, "The United Nations shall promote higher standards of living, full employment, and conditions of economic and social progress and development." In time, at least among practicing economists and academia, and policymakers and government, development came to be seen as improved economic opportunity through the accumulation of capital and rising productivity. The implicit assumption seemed to be that economic growth would lead to rising living standards, increases in life expectancy, reduced mortality, a reduction in the incidence of poverty, and so on. All of them, of course, worthy social goals. Between 1950 and 2001, world GDP per capita expanded at an annual average rate of 2.1%. And this expansion, although of course with considerable regional variations, was associated with a remarkable evolution in three key indicators of human welfare. In the 40-year period leading up to 2000, infant mortality fell from 140 to 52 per 1,000 live births. Average life expectancy at birth rose from 43 to 64 years, a 50% increase, which is nothing short of a spectacular. And adult illiteracy fell from 53 to 28%. Equally impressive was the sharp drop in the incidence of poverty. Data from a World Bank study show that between 1981 and 2001, what we often call the globalization phase of the 20th century, the share of the world's population living in extreme poverty fell from 40.4% to 21.1%. Now, while this left about 1.1 billion people living under harsh conditions, the existence of a positive trend was undeniable, and against the low expectations of the late 1940s, was a welcome development. Richard Cooper, for instance, notes that performance in the period 1950 to 2000 can only be described as fantastic in terms of the perspective of 1950, in the literal sense that if someone had forecast what actually happened, he would have been dismissed by contemporaries as living in a world of fantasy. There is, to be sure, continues Cooper, much work to be done since too many people still live in poverty. But it is also necessary to note success when there has been success to avoid drawing erroneous conclusions. I finish the quote from Cooper. Many critics, it seems to me, of development practices during the past half century will tend to focus on the unfinished agenda. The fact that, notwithstanding the gains made during this period, there is still too much poverty in the world, and that this poverty coexists uncomfortably with rising income disparities. Some of these critics call into question the very approach to development taken by such institutions as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and the aid agencies of the large donor countries, which also happen to be the largest shareholders of these two development organizations. Often, calls are made for a new development model, although it's not spelled out what that new development model should consist of, and equally importantly, whether such calls have any practical, conceptual, or political underpinnings. For a particularly incisive, very well thought out, non-dogmatic, unusually insightful analysis of the problems of the 58 poorest countries in the world, and what the international community can do about it, I would recommend to you Paul Collier's book, The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It. Now, the observation that economic growth had been the main engine of poverty reduction and other improvements in human welfare led many to ask themselves what could be done to accelerate growth everywhere, particularly in Africa, where the incidence of poverty actually rose during this period. This question acquired particular urgency among policymakers in the developing world given the pressing needs to continue to make progress in improving living standards, against the background of rising expectations among their respective populations.